coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Hello, everybody, and happy Tuesday evening. I hope everybody is doing all right out there. The world has been, well, more than a little exciting is the only way to put it right now. Look at that. Our good friend Hakim Isler has just joined the show. He was a little bit delayed. It's one of those, a lot of people get upset whenever a guest is delayed, things like that. I've always got good people. Mike Turber, I want to shout out to you right now, my friend. Number one, we will be getting Mike Turber back on the show. There are updates with the Route 91 shooting out of Las Vegas. That is, of course, how we came to know Mike Turber, was through our good friend Shannon Ray Caffey, who was injured at the Route 91 shooting. And he was the one that turned us on to Mike Turber. And it's been an amazing relationship since. He has new footage, new information about the Route 91 shooting. So we will be having him on to talk about that so very soon. Our guest tonight, as promised, though, is our good friend Hakim Isler. He is the founder of the first annual Psy Games. That is coming up in Charlottesville, Virginia, August 1st through 3rd. And like I said, I would love to blame somebody for being late. Life happens. But not only that, it's also the fact of Hakim is literally out there like teaching the next generation of ninjas. So I cannot fault a man for your dojo shuts down shortly before our show goes live. So the fact that you warp space and time to shut a dojo down, turn off lights, lock doors, and get over here for us live all the time is amazing, my friend. So thank you. Thank you for coming on again. As always, how have you been doing?
I've been doing good. And just to add to what you just said, the dojo, we get done with the last class at 8:20. It takes me 30 minutes to get home. And
it's a mad dash.
Yeah, so I was able to, and I have a 5,000 square foot facility with a 24-hour gym inside. So I had to shut it all down and been, like you said, space and time to somehow magically make it here with 2 minutes after. So,
well, and speaking of bending space and time, the topic for tonight is psychic ability. And the concept of psychic ability, and especially how that pertains to the Psy Games, which is once again coming up very shortly. I am so excited, A, that this event exists. You and I met at the Menlo Park Remote Viewing Association conference a couple years ago, and you were talking about getting this together, things like that, and you now have it together. This is going to be an amazing event. Tons of speakers, tons of events. Team competitions in the world of psychic powers, things like that. So how did you first come to be inspired to do this, Hakim? And how did you begin to even get this together?
Yeah, so the inspiration for it came kind of as a download of how do we keep moving forward in these abilities and unify people under this idea of psychic abilities. Mm. And so there are a lot of different people doing and practicing psi ability, but normally these people are just doing it in their own. They don't really have a goal other than to be, better than where they are. But we have this huge gap of people joining together to push themselves to the next level of what it would be like to be a fully empowered human being, to be able to fully actualize all of our abilities. And not everybody's going to be a yogi on a hill. And so that's definitely one way I totally believe in getting there. Do your meditations, become a really good person, zen out. But there are a lot of people who can use these skills or even have them that need a community, that need a way to develop these abilities. And so the side games kind of came as that. The final straw that really set the stage for the side games was I was listening to a Jeremy Corbell and George Knapp interview with the guy who wrote Skinwalker, the two guys that wrote Skinwalker at the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
The DIA, the ex-DIA agent who had wrote that book said, you know, if he, Jeremy asked him like, hey, there's all this stuff with these interdimensional beings and are they evil or whatever? And the guy was like, I see no danger here at all. He said, a matter of fact, and he stops himself and then he says, well, this is what I'll say. If human beings could reach their full capacity and embody their full capacity, we wouldn't have anything to be afraid of. So really the thing is getting us to that next level. And that's when it hit me. It was like, yes, that's the side games. That's where we can go. We do really well in a fun competitive spirit. There are negative competitive spirits, right?
Sure.
But there are fun competitive spirits. And as a matter of fact, as tribes, that's how we learned and grew. And you see bears and little cubs, tiger cubs and stuff. They play and they you know, they compete in fun little games. Yeah. They're not trying to kill each other, but ultimately they're preparing themselves to be in the wild. But we do really well when we have competitive play, you know, and we push ourselves to really high levels. And I mean, that's how we've broken a lot of the different records. That's how we've gotten this far. You know, that at one point there wasn't even an idea of going to the moon. And when we finally did get the idea of going to the moon, guess what? It was because we wanted to beat out the Russians. Yeah. So, and we did in this amazing amount of time, if you believe we actually went to the moon, but if not, that's a whole different story.
That's an entirely different episode. And I'm not about to get punched in the face by Buzz Aldrin. So, but in all reality, when you're talking about that, yes, Hakeem, the idea that we have a huge amount of potentiality locked up inside of us, mentally and spiritually. And it's pretty fascinating to see exactly how drawn away from that we are as a society.
Mm-hmm.
There are numerous societies around the world where those things are lauded. They're put forward in society, things like that, but not necessarily so here. And as we've talked about with psychic powers and even the concept of that, and I hesitate even just saying psychic powers. I say that as Kleenex, you know. I think that that's the only way that a lot of people understand the variety and variegation of talents and skills that there are when it comes to psychic powers. Everything, like, I would say, if anything, I am an empath when it comes to things, but I practice remote viewing. I probably have maybe a 40% hit rate, 45. I could probably use a whole lot more practice, Hakeem. But the fact that I'm hitting a 45 percentile to begin with,
mm-hmm.
as just somebody who casually practices, I am not at this every single day. Maybe once a week I do half a session, something like that, you know, but Even to see that potentiality there and some of the things that I have seen from folks like you at the conference, from other people like Carl McClellan this last year on the remote viewing cruise, some of the detail that people start pulling out in 5-10 minutes on a piece of paper is phenomenal. And it's literally plucked from another part of the universe. It's fascinating to think that, you know, we are regularly in altered states of consciousness, Hakeem, on the daily.
Yeah. I agree with you on that. And I think, you know, the ultimate goal is not just about the fun of it, which is a huge portion of it, but it's also, how do we make these things functional in our lives? Right. So I mean, we could all use a little bit more certainty through intuition, right?
Yep.
So people, you know, we go through a lot of struggles back and forth. Should I do this? Should I do that? Should I do this? Should I do that? You know, and, you know, we're trying to use it or solve it from a logical perspective, which is great. But then what about the other aspect? What about the intuitive perspective and really embracing that in a way where you could have that 50%, 40%, you know, hit rate in trusting myself and trusting my gut and knowing that that's happening. And so there's a lot to this that it's that goes beyond just the games themselves. And so that's really what we're trying to accomplish is to get people to a level where we move to the next evolution of where we are. And so there's this fear of like AI and transhumanism and things of that nature. And what I feel, you know, I know it sounds hokey, but, you know, if you watch The Matrix, I think that told a really good story. You have Neo, first he wakes up, he realizes that he's been interconnected with this computer and it's been kind of running his brain. There's fears that that might happen when we start putting chips in our brains, that if people can hack those and, you know,
sure,
you know, maybe they can, if we're using a chip to help us see, and it's doing whatever it does in there to allow us to see, maybe somebody can hack that and project images on the screen per se in our mind, have us seeing things that aren't really there. There are fears of that. There are fears of all these things, but really the human technology is one of the greatest technologies and we haven't even begun to really tap into what that really means.
Yeah, precisely.
You know, and so there's one group that says, oh, it's because you're not supposed to. There's another group that says, well, let me let any and everything in and do everything and get a, you know, dabble in this, dabble in that. That's not what we're talking about. There's a group that feels like the only way that you can do it or should do it is to go through a lot of rigorous, you know, moral and emotional cleansing, which I think is important. But then there's the everyday person who is a good person who just wants to be better at and grow in this way. And so how do we create an environment for them to feel welcome, for them to have community, and for them to actually take actions towards doing what it is that's necessary to get themselves to that level? Because, in again, going back to the Matrix, Neo woke up. Then he had that whole thing of like realizing that he could actually control the Matrix and the machines or what was going on inside the Matrix. And then he had another awakening later on in like the second one or the third one, where he realized he could actually influence the machines outside of the simulation. And we know that we can do that from the Paralab studies and all that stuff. We know psychokinesis is real and we can actually engage in with technology and be able to alter and shift technology. But, you know, and so if we could do that on a greater level, what would that look like? You know, and then would we really have to be afraid of AI? I mean, intellectually, AI has all of the knowledge of the world, you know, that it could just get in a moment. So maybe I can't process that fast, but I don't have to be afraid of it because I know that my capabilities as a human being will surpass it once I really embrace them and I learn how to develop them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, we regularly say on the show, I use AI for things. I was using AI earlier today. But here's the thing with generative AI, not generative AI, but with research AI, with things like Google and Grok and stuff like that. The example that I give all the time is Tay, the AI that Microsoft put into the wild in 2014, 2015, that was living on Twitter and began its life as approximately an 8-year-old intelligence. And within 24 hours, Microsoft took Tay offline because she had become a 16-year-old raving racist.
Wow.
Because the only thing it was fed was Twitter feeds.
Mm-hmm.
It got all of its data from Twitter. So when you're looking at Grok, when you're looking at, you know, ChatGPT, things like that, it's aggregating things from the internet. It is not verifying whether or not what it's aggregating is true.
Mm-hmm.
So it hallucinates. It ties fact with fiction. It does all kinds of things that are wild and out there. That, you know, like we say on the show all the time, it will be about as smart as the average person reading the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So take that as a good statement or a bad statement, whichever way you want to take that about the future of AI. But are we facing the Terminator anytime soon, or Skynet, or a self-sentient thing that will go Agent Smith on us and say that we are the disease that needs to be taken care of? I don't think so. I don't think we're going to hit that point, you know, because of the way AI is.
Yeah.
So the fact that, yes, our brains will always be superior to those things. There is a vast amount of wetware inside of our head that already exists. And the fact that we are already connected just on a quantum level, mm-hmm. Hakeem, the idea that, you know, we're bound by a quantum field, but we're 90% empty space,
mm-hmm.
you know, your atoms and my atoms are literally commingling right now, according to that hypothesis. So, yeah, spooky action at a distance, quantum entanglement, things like that. We are the fabric of the universe, and we can vibrate the fabric of the universe. And it's pretty interesting when you start digging into that.
Yeah, yeah, I concur. And I think that's the new frontier. You know, consciousness is the new frontier. And, you know, even when we look at UAP and all of this stuff, there seems to be a growing number of people who are starting to say that's all about consciousness as well.
Yeah.
And so we think of it, these things, as separate, but really we're finding that we're more interconnected. And when you do remote viewing, and when you are able to do mind sight and all of these things, you start recognizing that in a very intimate way, that we are actually connected, and we are all unified on some level. And that's where this whole picture starts to grow.
Yeah. And
zoom out, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that idea of connectivity, especially, and it's something that when you start looking at society in and of itself, I tell my wife all the time, make no mistake, we've always been this horrifying, sadly. The only difference is you didn't wake up with the news from Poughkeepsie in the palm of your hand, you know, like even when we were kids, Hakeem, even 20 years ago. You know, when the internet was just burgeoning, stuff like that, we didn't have that, mm-hmm. you know, like maybe you could get the New York Times at your local newsstand or something like that. But the idea that now it is literally a sensory overload of data and incoming information. And it's to the fact that one of the studies that we show on screen all the time, whenever we're talking about targeted individuals, things like that. Is the actual study from the National Institute of Health showing that negative news cycles bruise the hippocampus of the brain.
Mm.
So, like, and we always compare it to the COVID times, the times that we were locked away with just negative news cycles shoved in our face 24/7 on the feed or on TV, no matter where you went in the house. It was everywhere like that. And the idea of living in that kind of state of mind, living in a constant state of panic, living in a constant state of fear, even, like you said, to come to understand that these things are normality. These abilities are normal. And to let people understand that they're normal, that they aren't something that they should be afraid of. I think is a huge part of that.
Yes. Yes. I concur with that 100%. And I hope that we all see that. We, you know, it's really odd right now, you know, to as the Cygames is growing and becoming more known and prevalent. And, you know, we have a lot of different emails coming in, and, you know, quite often they're positive, but there are some that aren't so positive. And I'm really surprised by that. And people who are claiming to be these bearers of and protectors of consciousness, but they have no compassion, and they have, and they're telling us what we're doing wrong and how we're doing the world of injustice and this, that, and other. And if I do respond, I'm like, hey, well, come show up. Let's be friends. Let's try, you know, if you have a suggestion, let's hear it. And they don't they don't want to do that. They just want to put out there this negative vibe about how they're right, because, you know, whatever entity they communicated with told them that they were right, and how we're wrong. And we're not going to go anywhere that way. You know, we're not going to go anywhere. And I find it very strange to have a conversation about compassion and love with a person who's saying that they are compassionate and loving. But then when I say, well, let's be compassionate and loving, they say, oh, no, not for you.
Yeah, yeah. Like, well, I mean, I'm
this conversation.
Up till that point, I'm compassionate and loving. and you know, the idea of, and this goes to numerous communities. You and I were literally talking about this earlier today, man. The idea of, even in the paranormal community, the cryptozoology community, research is supposed to be enjoyable in some kind of way, shape, or form. That's why you do it, because you're passionate about it and you love it. But the idea of community, the idea of research within a community, like you're saying, it doesn't behoove us to not be open to the conversation. Literally, the last lines of this show before I say bye-bye are, you know, your open hearts, your open minds. That's what makes the conversation. And without that, humanity does not march forward. You know, because whether you agree with somebody or not, you've got to be willing to, without wanting to change their paradigm, just understand what they think and believe, just for the sake of what they think and believe. You know, to widen your keyhole to look at the universe and to look at those things. So, and the idea that, like I told you, whenever I made my first boosted ad for ticket sales, I started getting attacked by people who were like, what you're doing is demonic. And it's like, yo, hold on. Like, we went, like, that was a deep, dark rabbit hole real quick, man. And it's like, whoa, wait a minute. Because once again, these are, as Lynn Buchanan says all the time, everybody is psychic. Everybody. We all are tapped into this. The only question is, you know, much like saying that I can't shoot a basketball. Yes, you can. As long as you have arms and you have the ability to move them, guaranteed you can shoot a basketball. You may not be as naturally apt as Hakeem Olajuwon. You know, you may be as apt as me, which is not good. I kept stats, you know, but it doesn't mean that you can't do it. So, yeah, like we all have these natural aptitudes. The only difference is some people are a little bit better at them than other. And of course, through training, through honing any skill, you tend to get better at it. So let's start focusing on that for the next 20-30 minutes here, Hakeem. How did, especially, like I said, you just came from teaching the next generation. How do you begin to open somebody's mind, somebody who has just stepped into your dojo for the first time, has never done mind sight, has never, you know, held a wooden katana with a blindfold on, getting ready to smack something that's flying at them? How do you prepare them for that and begin to open that door for them?
Yeah. So one of the things I learned from being a yoga practitioner and being a yogi, is to meet people where they are. Right. And so for everybody, it's different. Some people come in, they're all gung-ho. They want just that stuff. And some people don't want that stuff right away. And some people don't want that stuff at all. They want other stuff. And so really understanding who the individual is that we're working with, and then taking it from that perspective. And because we are different individuals, I think that's where the hallmark of a true teacher comes into play, is that, you know, the way Chris is going to learn and the comfort level that Chris has is different than the comfort level and the way that Hakeem is going to learn. So as a good teacher, even though I have both of them in the class, I tailor my speech and I tailor what I show to them as individuals. You know, there's another type of teacher. I could be cookie cutter. I could just say, this is the way that we're going to do it. And you just have to be like me, you know. And if you're not, then go to another school. And that's not my way, my personal way. That's not the way I believe. That's not the way I was taught. And that's why when these folks call me and say, or they email and they say, you're wrong, this is the way it's got to be because I was told, or this is the way I believe, or whatever that. I'm like, well, we are fundamentally not in the same vein. Our philosophical difference are fundamentally different. And so, or our philosophical beliefs are fundamentally different. And so we, you know, mine embraces you and yours is telling me, can only tell me about how I need to be like it. Right. And that's not who I am. And that's not what the Psy Games is. And that's also not how I teach. I embrace you. If you're not hurting anybody, of course, if you're, if you know, I am a martial artist, so if I feel like you're, you know, a bad person trying to hurt somebody, then I'm going to step up and say, hey, don't do that. You know, I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to embrace you maybe in another way. If you're trying to hurt people. But other than that, hey, we can get along, you know, we can find some common. And even if we can't find common ground on what our belief system is around this thing, then we can agree to disagree and maybe look for other means for us to be able to find connection or find friendship. You know, I mean, I got a ton of friends. I don't agree with everything.
Yeah,
who they are. I mean, there's some fun, you know, again, if you are a criminal hurting people, then we're not friends. But if you are a person who just believes different than me on certain topics that don't deal with hurting people, then yeah, we can be friends. We can have differences.
Absolutely.
Differences of opinion. And that's not, that doesn't seem to go well with where we are in our modern day right now, you know, whether it be on politics or religion or whatever. You know, people are very, this is my way. This is the way I believe in the crew that I hang with. And so you have to believe in. And if you don't, then I have the right to tell you you're wrong, and why you're wrong, and why you need to believe and act the way I do. And that's not okay.
Yeah.
In my
I would tend to agree with that. As somebody who taught children for years and years, again, because it's not what you're supposed to be, you know, and it's not how we're supposed to be. Once again, we're supposed to be open, free, things like that, and especially free to be able to find that path that befits us best. Really in that holistic Montessori aspect of education, you know, because once again, you may have three different students that all walk in together, but all need to follow a slightly different path to the same goal. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I talk about regularly on other shows that I guest on, as you know, I make binaural beat music, all kinds of things. And the idea that frequency is not just a sound. And it's not just a color, it's a thought form. A frequency of thought has to occur before the frequency of sound comes out of your mouth. So how important, especially when it comes to mindset, when it comes to frequency of thought and how you're thinking about approaching a session, how you're thinking about approaching the task at hand with Psy abilities, how important is that to Psy and to Psy teaching?
Yeah, that's a beautifully well put question. And so many traditions that practice or deal with us understanding our multidimensional nature have two main things that they talk about. One is this consciousness aspect, and the other is what do you do with it, and how do you do with it what you need to do. And the key to that, the tool or whatever, or the device, it's not a device, but the tool, you, the way you bring it into the world or use it or direct it, is through intention. So consciousness and intention, that intentionality is like, consciousness is like the wizard and the intentionality is like the wand, you know?
Yeah.
So consciousness is this great potential, like the wizard would have a great potential, you know, and all of this ability, but, you know, can't really focus it. And so to focus that intention, to focus that ability, the wizard needs the wand, you know?
Yeah.
In a good control over the wand to be able to do that. And that's really what I think is the key, is that all of this starts with your intention, you know, and how you intend to make this happen, the frame of mind you are in when you make those and set those intentions. Are you in a negative frame of mind? Are you in a positive frame of mind? Are you in a good spirit? Are you in a bad spirit? Are you doing this with compassion and love or anger and hate? Right?
Yeah,
that's the, and if I was to take this analogy even further, that's the wood your wand is made out of, you know, like, is it made out of the anger and hate wood, or is it made out of the love and compassion wood?
Well, and, you know, here's the thing. I can already hear the demon critics in the background right now, Hakeem, talking about, like, you're talking about casting spells right now. It's like, that's funny. If you listen to Joel Osteen, he talks about the exact same thing on a Sunday morning when it's like, you gotta have a vision board where you've got your intention laid out, you know, and it's something that I've told people for years, whenever, especially once I hear somebody, we hang out, we have a drink or three or four a few times, and I hear them talk about the same thing. I'll normally tell them, like, you know, you need to put that on a calendar.
Mm.
And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, actively put that on a calendar. Like, I will have this done by this date. Like mine was the new remote viewing journal, which I was like, I need to have it ready by the time I speak at Cygames. So I gave myself a due date of July 1st. It was on my calendar, like July 1st. This is the due date, like circled. And once you put it down, like you've hoisted the sail and set that intention out on the sea. Now, you don't do that goal. That's utterly up to you. And you're the reason now, and you can just admit the fact that you're the reason it didn't happen, not because you didn't try, but it's because you didn't try. But the idea of putting intention forth, and the intention behind that intention, you know, one of the things that we've talked about quite a few times on this show was during the first Trump election. There was a coven of witches across the country that were actively casting black spells against Trump, like publicly saying this. And it's like, well, you know, number one, that's pretty well against the principles of witchcraft to begin with. Like, pretty sure there's a threefold rule in there, ladies. So they kept doing it. He got elected. He said he was running again. They said, we're going to cast some more spells. And it's like, yo, wait a minute. Like, number one, you're trying to do harm to somebody. Mm-hmm. That's no good. No good can actively come of that, either to them or yourself. You know, and when you start, I know it's hippy dippy, folks, to think about things in that karmic rule concept. But when you're looking at it, even from a point of physics, even from a point of an audio engineer, whatever sound I put into that microphone is only going to come out of the speaker louder.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's how that works. And then the microphone hears the speaker. And then the speaker hears the microphone that hears the speaker. And then you get feedback eventually if the signal's too hot and it's too rough. Yeah. You know, like that's just physics. That's how that works. So, a slinky will just sit in your hand if you don't push that potential energy that's inside of it. Same thing with the universe. It's a coiled spring of intention energy, but you have to push it. It ain't going to slink down the stairs if you don't push it down the stairs.
Yeah. This is very true. Very true. And in our ninjutsu training, we have a thing called sunmitsu, which is this idea of thought, word, and deed. It's this threefold, point that allows us, or a triangle or a trigram that allows us to understand how we manifest things in the world. First, you think it, you get that thinking frequency, like you said, then that turns into a verbal or a sound frequency. And then that allows for a physical frequency, something physical to happen, matter to start to change, matter to start to be influenced. And then that leads to the manifestation of the thing, So think it, speak it, do it is really this idea of sunmitsu. And that is a powerful tool. It is the tool. It is the tool. You know, when a person has a thought, speaks about that thought, gathers the resources, and through speaking about it is normally how they gather the resources. I've personally not met, maybe as somebody out there, I've personally not met anyone who thought about something and never spoke about it in any way, shape, or form. Even if they don't have words, they probably use sign language to communicate with somebody to buy the items to be able to build the thing, or ask someone, how is it done? Or talk to somebody about their idea, that normally is if you look at people who make things happen in the world, they on some level follow that guideline. So this thought, word, deed, and in the process, of doing that, they manifest whatever it is that they were thinking about and speaking about, and then we're working on in the physical realm. So, that's and I think we will learn that here at the Side Games as well, is what is that intentionality? What is that thing that we do? How do they relate to one another and really bring this about into the world? So,
Well, and you have a few disciplines that are going to be tested in a few categories, things like that. Remote viewing, as we've said, mind sight, dowsing, psychokinesis, precognition. Let's get into mind sight real quick, because I that's one that I know my audience has heard. We've definitely talked about it whenever you've been on the show. But how does mind sight operate? And how do you teach that modality to somebody?
Well, so there's different ideas behind how people believe mind sight operates. And some people won't call it mind sight,
sure,
call it something else. And scientifically, if you look in the NIH, you'll see that there are research papers done on it. They call it extraocular vision in those papers. So that's be another one. The idea is that, one school I trained with, they said that it is the vibration that you're picking up off of different items. So, which makes total sense, right? If you understand how the eye works and how color and light and all this stuff happens, that all colors are a vibratory, frequency, that are hitting your eyes, and then your eyes kind of make sense of it. And it through your brain, and it, flips the image and does all this stuff. But that image itself is just a series of frequencies hitting your eye, and then your brain making sense of it. So, it stands that if you did not have your eyes, that if it's a frequency and our bodies can pick up frequencies in multiple different ways, that you would be able to pick up the same frequency, even though you didn't have your eyes. Now, there are some people that say that one of the things that can pick this frequency up is the pineal gland, right? So it can send and receive frequencies. And actually in the pineal gland, some people say it differently. There are photoreceptors, inside. Yeah. And that's how we are able to sense light. For us, in the absence of light, which makes us tired, which allows us to produce melatonin, right? And then the flip side, when light comes up, we know that we need to wake up, you know? And I think it's what serotonin that gets produced.
Yeah.
And so this idea of, you know, this little, almost pine cone shaped, you know, thing in our minds that can still sense light and darkness and allows us and has our body produce these things, is also an aspect of that. So there are many different ways that people are trying to say that this works and how this works. And so we're all trying to figure it out. I've met a teacher. One of my teachers said, it's your higher self. It has nothing to do with any of this stuff. It's like a greater version of your spirit outside of your body that is out there looking around or swimming in consciousness and is able to see these things around you. So
yeah, and
that's one, another experience.
Well, and once again, to take it to that quantum science level, this is something that I talk about in my talk, Hakeem. Spoiler alert. But it's the idea of multidimensional science and the idea that we know that there are at least 11 dimensions. And if we are spreading in a three-dimensional way, atomically and on an atomic level, then yeah, the same way that atoms and things like that, or particles of atoms, things like that, pass through other dimensions all the time, we would be doing the same thing. Our consciousness would be doing the same thing, you know, and that's even, you know, the idea that dreaming may be a slipstream into that daydreaming may be a slipstream into that, that remote viewing may be a slipstream into those things. Same thing with astral projection. It is the idea that this is something that we bring up on the show all the time. Your brain is not a computer. It's a transducer. It is there transmitting and receiving radio signals constantly.
Yeah, there's a book called Stealing Fire, and they talk about a research project where they were able to kind of send these electrical impulses to the brain of a donkey and get it to kind of and navigate it across this far distance. Mm-hmm. And when they needed it to go left, they kind of sent this signal and then the donkey went left. And when they needed it to go right, they sent the signal. And they were trying to, unfortunately, weaponize that as a way of mind control. But they were able to succeed. Now, of course, we don't know what happened to it because they say they shut it down. And of course, you know, anyone who would think that was used in a negative light, they'd say, oh, you're just crazy, you know?
Yeah.
But ultimately, that's if it worked the way they said it were, which, you know, it was a peer reviewed thing, then, I would straight to say that it's probably still out there floating around somewhere.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've just pulled up right now the article from NIH.gov about the missing manuscripts from Jose Delgado's radio controlled bull experiments. Mm. And those happened way back. That was 1960s. 1960s, where he had an implant embedded into a bull, then and like it would charge at him full speed, and he just hit a button and it would stop, or turn left or turn right, things like that. So yeah, the idea that we can do that, and that we could possibly do that beyond implant as well. that when you're talking about people talented enough, people like Lynn Buchanan, who were able to influence and wreck computers with psychic ability, things like that. It's fascinating to see those things.
Yeah, I think so, and I think we are just on the cusp. And what my goal is with the Psy Games is to gamify it, make it fun. Make it exciting, where it's not like this super overly serious thing where we can just get together and have a good time and we can be friends and we can have a community. And then also we can help raise up the next generation, which there is nobody really doing that, you know, really making it so that the next generation can get involved in this in a way that's going to be exciting, in a way that's going to change things. That's really what we're looking for. And so if you look at a lot of events that cover this space, there are not any children.
Yeah.
You know, I've, all the ones I've gone to, I might see one kid or two running around somewhere, but out of thousands of adults, you know, or hundreds of adults.
Yeah.
So, you know, this year at the Sci Games, we'll probably have like 40 kids, you know?
Yeah. That's awesome. That is awesome. So
that's a great, you know, a great number for a first time. And then once we grow, I'm sure we'll have more. And that's really what it is. It's about like, if these kids are interested and they have the ability and they want to learn from quality mentors, you know, one of the things I got from the telepathy tapes was hearing the parents say, I was having this experience with my child and I didn't know where to go.
Yeah.
And I didn't know who to talk to. And my friend Diane Hennessy Powell, she was receiving all these letters from people when they found out that she was willing to talk to people about what was happening with their children, because there was no, these people felt hopeless. They were like, you know, if I go to the normal psychiatrist, they're going to think I'm crazy, and then they're going to think my kid's crazy, and they're going to put them on medication. And I know that that's not what they need. I know they are reading my mind, and I don't know who to talk to about it.
Brother, you know, and it's, once again, across numerous communities like that. We just had Dr. Rose on all of a couple weeks ago talking about the normalization of paranormal and the psychological necessity of the normalization of paranormal, you know, because when you've, even whenever, once again, these people's paranormal experience was their child being precognizant of what they were thinking inside of their head, that kind of stuff, which in and of itself is a paranormal thing. And yes, can throw you for a loop, can throw you to such ontological shock that your life changes. It's like somebody has pried the keyhole that you look through open with a crowbar. And the key just don't fit right anymore, man, you know? And it, to the point where, like, I am right now with Curious Research, working on a protocol for Experiencers Anonymous, where there will now be a safe space for people to come and anonymously sit in a circle of other experiencers and be in a non-judgmental space to be able to share these things, you know, because it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. And how do we get to a point of being okay with talking about it?
Yes.
Yes. You know, because you've got to be okay to talk about it to begin with. Like, even a scientist has to be okay to talk about it, you know? And that's one of the things that we bring up on the show all the time, is the idea of not only paranormal researchers, like, that's why we made the observation journal, was so that as you're out in the field, you can gather things in a scientific way with other scientific data, in addition to what you witnessed, what experience you had. That way, come the day that you find a scientist that's interested, you have things written down in a scientific manner. You know, not just like, here's my picture. And in the other vein, the scientist has to be ready for somebody to come along with a crowbar and maybe open up his keyhole a little bit from the box of science that he has lived in, and be willing to take on the idea of anomaly. Like, I am a big fan of the relabeling of UFO to UAP. Because of the inclusion of anomaly, you know, like, anomaly is something that inside of a scientific data set, you have to discount when you're trying to prove your hypothesis. So if an anomaly pops up in the middle of your experiment, you got to chase the anomaly down so that you can prove it's not part of the experiment.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's interesting the fact that because of that, I think. Because of the relabeling of that one simple thing, so many other scientists are coming forward with interest in things, you know, and there are scientists like we talked about it before, Hal Puthoff right here in Austin, you know, working on how to squeeze a vacuum to get energy out of it. You know, things, and I don't mean like your home vacuum, folks. I mean like the vacuum of space, like empty space. How to piezoelectrically get power out of empty space by compressing it. Fascinating stuff. But the reason why a laser scientist was the one that wrote the paper and part of the paper that begat remote viewing is because specifically a laser scientist has to know how to vibrate a medium. Mm-hmm. Whether it's a solid, a gas, a wafer of semiconductor, you have to know how to vibrate that medium to such a point that it changes the way photons react as it passes through that medium. You know? So there's a different idea of vibration at that point and your connectedness to that vibration. And yeah, there's a reason why he's read into UFO UAP programs. There's a reason why he's working on sucking energy out of a vacuum, because the man just thinks about the world and the universe in a totally different way.
Yes. Yes. You know, I concur with that. And he's a great individual.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And it was amazing to meet him at Menlo Park, things like that. And to be able to be, just have a human conversation with him about such things. Mm-hmm. Because it really does come down to that. And it's fascinating that, once again, whether you're talking about mainstay Christianity or Eastern religion or science, it all comes down to vibration and your connection to it.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to feel that tickle in your belly, you know, yeah, and be able to trust that implicitly when you feel it, you know. Yeah. So yeah. How do you begin? We've got about 10 minutes left here, Hakeem. In that time, let's spend the next few minutes. How do people begin the road of discernment when it comes to, because I think that's really the outer nutshell of the sweet meat that is psi games, psychic abilities, all of it, is that power of discernment to learn when to tell the difference between a hit, yeah, and a miss, and to understand that, hey, the misses are just as important as the hits.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a tough, slippery slope, because you are talking about listening to certain feelings that may not have any hard factual basis until something happens that may be in the future, you know? And on the flip side, though, there's a way to do that and trust a little bit too much. You know, I've had conversations where people who are just willing to accept whatever, and they talk it as though it's fact, you know. Mm. Oh, I felt this, or I witnessed this, or da da da. And it's like, okay, well, or, you know, this person told me that, you know, I'm from another planet and I'm supposed to act like this. And it's, you know, and people will sometimes embrace that without actually giving it any deep thought. And it's okay. If you give it deep thought, I can't really harm you for it, or not harm you, but knock you for it.
Yeah.
But if you are just accepting it like right off the cuff, that's a different thing. I think one of the cool parts is to have some sort of really strong mentor who's grounded, who knows how to have a good balance between subjectivity and objectivity, and who is discerning. And that's a good way to start. It can be very challenging to start on your own because you don't know who to trust, yeah, or how to trust, or if you're learning from somebody online and they're saying, oh, I'm superhuman guy who knows all this stuff, and really they're just some person who went on, who just was failing in their life at everything else, saw this consciousness thing, watched a bunch of TikTok or YouTube videos, and within a month decided they were going to put together their own class and then,
yeah,
create a backstory. And now you're paying them $10,000 because their website looks cool and sexy, and they have the gift of gab, and now they got you sucked in, and now you don't even really know, they don't know what you're doing, and you don't really know what you're doing, you know?
Yeah.
So I say, start slow. Understand the history. I think that's a good place to start.
Yep.
Because if you understand the history, then what you start doing is you start rooting yourself in the knowledge and the facts of the research that was done before. And from that research, it will help you find people and understand the field a little bit better. But if you start from a place where it's like the first person that pops up that looks kind of cool on the internet, that's who I'm going to go with.
Yeah.
And they've been doing this for 5 years, then you're not really sure what you're getting, you know? And that's one of the other reasons, one of the other things that I wanted with the side games is I wanted to have mentors that you can track their records and see how far back they go, you know, like a Paul Smith or, Diane Hennessy Powell, Julia Mossbridge, you know, all these different folks that have been doing this for a long time, you know, Adam Curry, Tom Campbell. I mean, God, you know, the guy's been around forever, you know, Daniel Sheehan. I mean, their history speaks for itself. Absolutely. They've been around 40 years, 50 years, you know, studying, researching this stuff. They didn't just start, you know, a year ago.
Precisely.
And like, precisely. I'm going to do this Dale Graff. I mean, like, read that guy's story, you know, Alan Steinfeld, his story, you know, Vincent, Pam Coronado. I had our own show on Discovery Channel. I mean, these guys are professionals. That Christopher Jordan.
Yeah, I don't know about him, though. I don't know
if he's any good or anything, but but he looks cool. You know, he's got a cool place that he does all the stuff. So we had to have him. But, you know, that would be some advice, you know. Find something that feels right and that has some roots.
Yeah.
And that is a good place to start.
That is perfect advice. You know, the idea of just like we were saying with the AI a while ago, you can't really just give things a cursory glance. You really do have to dig into the footnotes of things, you know, and hard root and research this stuff to be able to find out who is legitimate, who is good, who has had a good track record. Things like that, because there's 101 people out there, no different than the number of tarot card signs that you see up in New Orleans. You know, it's one of those. How do you know that they're good? How do you guarantee that and make sure that everybody, because even a teacher, you know, it can be the fact of I'm of the mind, if they're taking on too many students, are they actively giving every student their proper time? So same thing, like if it's I hate using the analogy, but if it's that puppy mill concept of let's get 85 people in class, you know, in a Zoom meeting, that kind of stuff, you need to that should be red flags, that kind of stuff. So
I love Paul's class because Paul is very adamant about 6 people max, maybe, or maybe 8 if he has enough support. But normally in that 6 person class, he's going to have 2 assistants, including himself. I mean, that's type of one-on-one you just don't get.
That's it. And it's hugely important, massively important. Even whenever Carl McClellan and Michelle Freed came and did their class here in Austin with Vantage Point Remote Viewing, it was awesome because it was like 8 of us with 2 of them, you know. Mm-hmm. So we got a lot of one-on-one, we got a lot of time in class to be able to talk back and forth and be able to process data as it came out and be able to do that in real time. And it's great, you know, whenever you can deep dive into that. That's what it's supposed to be about. And if you're not getting that experience, you really do need to consider that, folks. Hakeem, in the last couple minutes, let everybody know, A, how they can get their tickets to PsyGames, B, how they can get involved, because you guys have a volunteer rung where people can come help out, all kinds of things like that. You also still have openings for contestants and that kind of stuff, as well as teams, everything else. So let's get into all of that real quick before we sign off in this segment.
Yeah, so we're only 30 days out. So actually, we have our teams and all that stuff set now. So we're going to start releasing information about those folks here soon. There are, you know, we did close down volunteers, but we may have room for one or two more. So if anybody wanted to email thesigames@gmail.com, then they can do that and they can get a hold of us and check us out. The Psy Games spelled PSI, just for those who may not be in the know, thesigames@gmail.com. And then if they want to get a ticket, they can go to the website, PSIGamesInternational.com, and they can get a ticket still. And because of your show, you know, they'll get we're giving you like a code where they can get like 20% off, and you'll have that promo code. I'm sure you'll put it in the show notes like you've done in the past.
Yep.
And so we have that for people too, so they can even get a discount when they're involved in this. You know, we got some amazing sponsors that you see down there, DMT Quest. We got Brighter Earth, you know, Prosper. We got Buffalo Dragonfly, Monroe Institute. I mean, these guys are all amazing people that are going to be supporting this event. The International Remote Viewing Organization, Center Lane, Roxiva, Weird. So there's so many people that are involved that really want to see this come into fruition and really be something for our communities, for the next generation and our generation and the generations to come. Maybe it changes our DNA and opens us up in a way that now this becomes like an epigenetic thing where now the next generation is more psychic because we put in the work this generation. I don't know. Maybe.
Well, you know, the first thing that it takes over anything is being open of mind and being willing to have that conversation once again. Mm-hmm. So if you have a young child, things like that, it's one of those you don't have to entertain every whim and fancy, folks. But give it a chance. Think about it. And start looking at your child and start looking at the way your child describes things in a different way, because they have a totally different means of communication than us. They do not have, especially I find under the age of 10, especially once 10 comes, there's a different set of rules when it comes to suspension of disbelief in the world around you. And into that interlocked sense of belonging with the world around you and the go along to get along, you know, of no, I didn't see that, or no, I didn't feel that. You did. You just ignored it because go along to get along. And that's really where most of us sadly end up as adults, Hakeem, is that go along to get along mentality. And we begin to ignore those deep down feelings that we have, those inklings that we know to be true, you know, those things that are literally intrinsically a part of us, you know. So I want to thank you for your time tonight. Number one, your time tonight. Also, your time in putting PsyGames together. I think that it is really a massively important event when it comes to getting this out there, not only for today, but for future generations, because much like any paranormal research, any of it, if we don't get 8-year-olds excited about it now, at what point will they get reinvigorated about it? You know, they may not find this topic again until they're 40 years old. And there goes 30 years of possible involvement in research. You know, and you got to start way back at square one instead of maybe just being on square 2.5, 3, a couple steps ahead of the game, you know, because you had an open mind. So I think what you're doing is massively important for the community and carrying this forward to future generations. So thank you for everything that you've done. Before we let you go, Hakeem, let everybody know one last time where they can go to get their tickets, where they can go to sign up to be a participant.
Yeah, we would love to have you. It's going to be PSIGamesInternational.com, PSIGamesInternational.com. www.ticketmaster.com. And you can go there and sign up and register for your ticket. We have different tiered tickets. So if you just kind of want to, you know, dip your toe in, you can. But if you want the full experience with, we got a VIP meet and greet, and we have like a sky watch with Chris Bledsoe and a bunch of other things, a performance by this experiential singer. I mean, it's going to be super amazing. You know, then you can get the platinum version, and it's just up to you at what level. We also have something that's really beautiful as well. Kids 6 to 14 are free.
Wow.
They get to come and they get to enjoy this. And we have a kids playroom, and we'll have some of the instructors come in there and do things like spoon bending with the kids.
Oh, cool.
And then parents of those children get a 30% discount on their ticket. You know, because again, this is about a family, how to get the family involved and have them involved. And we know it can be expensive to pack the whole family up, drive them across the country, put them up in a hotel. So we're like, hey, we'll let your kids come and do their thing for free, and we'll give you 30% off your ticket.
Absolutely awesome. Hakeem, once again, thank you so much for your time tonight, and thank you for everything that you do for the community when it comes to Cygames. So I can't wait to see you in person at the end of the month. It's going to be great. Man.
Yeah, I'm going to give you a big hug.
Absolutely. And with that in mind, I'm going to go ahead and let you go, because once again, you've had a full day of teaching, things like that. Thanks so much for your time tonight, my friend. I'll be in touch with links, all that kind of good stuff. Take care.
All right.
Absolutely. Man, it's always a great conversation talking with Hakeem Isler, folks. Make sure to stop on by CyGamesInternational.com. That is where you can get your tickets. While you are online checking out Cygames International, make sure to stop on by Curious Research. Curious Research is the home of everything that we do involved with paranormal, parapsychological, UFO, UAP research, folks. And our latest book is out now. Everything in our store, all of our binaural beat music, all of our books and journals that we put out for researchers, all of the proceeds go to further research in the paranormal and UAP encrypted communities. Our latest book is The Remote Viewing Session Journal. If you are a remote viewer, this gives you 50 sessions, 8 pages per session, to be able to log down all your data from a session, to be able to look at sessions next to each other, compare and contrast data, all that kind of good stuff. Stop on by, get your copy today. That is available on Amazon. Just search Remote Viewing Session Journal, and you will be able to get that. When we come back from this quick break, folks, we will be joined by our good friends Jared Murphy and Christy Bass from ArchaeoX. We will be talking about the world of lost civilizations, technologies that were lost by civilization, how many times we've been regenerated as a civilization, and medicines from lost civilization, indigens, things like that. So we will be getting into lost civilizations with ArchaeoX when we come back right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com. Or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much for hanging on through that. And also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you are a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by True Hemp Science today. They are your source for amazing CBD products. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science create their product through a spigyric process using every part of the hemp plant, from seeds and stems to roots to buds to leaves. Every part of the plant is used, reused, combusted, and reused through the same process to create an amazing full spectrum product complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by and check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. In this segment, we are very glad to welcome back our good friends Jared Murphy and Christy Bass from ArchaeoX. They are actively helping facilitate an amazing release of a book tomorrow, folks. So stop on by and check out the book Extreme Humanity. You can find that over at the website extremehumanity.com. We'll also be talking about the unique website or web release of this book that's going to be like a live Q&A, all kinds of fun stuff. So welcome back to the show, Jared, Christy. How are you guys doing today?
We are doing great. Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for having us back.
Always great to have you on, Jared. Christy, welcome back to the show. Now, you guys over at ArchaeoX do some amazing stuff. Y'all have, of course, been involved with your digs in Belize, things like that. But in addition to that, you work with a lot of other researchers. You guys communicate and tie in with a lot of other researchers. How did you come to work with Michael Cremo to begin with and get the opportunity, the amazing opportunity to help him release his new book, Extreme Humanity?
Well, that's all Jared.
Extreme Human Antiquity.
Oh, Extreme Human Antiquity. Sorry.
Yeah. It's his latest book. Originally, when I was writing my book, I read Forbidden Archaeology, and I had heard about it. I knew it was a seminal work and it was important. And I started reading it and I'm like, yeah, this ties exactly into extreme advanced, likely advanced human cultures. And so I included him in the book. And then when I started doing interviews for my book a few years ago, then there were people who wanted me to co-host, and I got the opportunity to interview Michael, and I guess we hit it off. He couldn't believe I'd actually written his book. I actually read it. And then a bunch of interviews later, and fast forward, I'm doing my own podcast. And then the opportunity, once Christy and I worked out what we were doing with ArchaeoX, I'm like, hey, you know, let's have Michael back on. And at the same time, during our research to Belize and the LIDAR work and the things we were doing on the pyramid, the Mayan pyramids, we were able to, I was able to do a conference in Upper Michigan, which is the Ancient American Artifact Preservation Society. And Cremo was the lead speaker, and myself and our other partner, Tom Elmore, we spoke, and I got to sit next to Lori and Michael actually in person. We had a booth, and even though I'd interviewed him a bunch, it was the first time that Michael and I got to see each other face to face, and we hit it off even more. And that's how we got to here, where we're not only hosting this webinar, but we're actually going to co-host. That's something else, I guess, Chris. We are going to now co-host. Christy and I are going to co-host a podcast with Michael monthly.
Wow. That is amazing. And of course, you know, Michael Cremo has been in the world of forbidden archaeology for years and years. And it's something that we've talked about on the show regularly, Jared, the idea of lost civilizations, not just, and not necessarily the concept of like a master builder race, but the idea that our civilizations have been reinvented time and time again. One of my favorite book titles in the world is your book title. It's not aliens worse, it's us. The fact that we have forgotten ourselves time and time again.
Yeah, it's awful and scary and weird, right?
Yeah. Yeah, well, and it really doesn't take long. One of the things that we talked about last time we had you guys on was the digs going on in Belize and the way that the local population sees what is found as an opportunity to monetize and as an opportunity to sell things to support their village. We see it as something that needs to go in a museum, you know, and it's interesting the idea that they know that the civilization is there. They know that temples are there. They know all of that, but it's literally kind of like we were talking about before the show, Christy, when you come back from something that's so magnificent and amazing, it's hard not to see the everyday of life. And they're so busy seeing the everyday of life and trying to just live a life living out in the jungle that they don't have time to uncover ruins. If they run across a shard of pottery or a piece of flaked arrowhead or something from the previous civilization, they go out and sell it so that they can buy rice, beans, food, things like that.
Maslow's hierarchy is relevant everywhere.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter, you know, what your socioeconomic status is, what country you live in or culture, the hierarchy is valid and relevant everywhere. Yeah.
No, precisely. And, you know, something we've spoken about regularly on the show, Jared, you and I, is the idea of Terra Preta, this amazing agro-tech that has been around for millennia. There are places in the Amazon that were sown and made into Terra Preta generations and generations ago that are still better soil than the surrounding Amazon.
Absolutely. And there's no acknowledgement of it, even though it's well known and well documented. And you're the guy who brought up, I mean, when way back, you were the one bringing up Terra Preta, the studies with Cornell.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll bring that up right now because it's pretty interesting. It's becoming kind of a modern agricultural product. Farms are starting to look at it here. A lot of agro, like macro agro, people like that are like doing home farming, homesteading, things like that are starting to look into it. So it's pretty interesting. But when you start looking at, here is the science article from science.org about it. I'll find the study from Cornell University. But the idea that, once again, this is a technology that we are just discovering. So
yeah.
Let's explore that for a minute. How do we get to a point, Jared, that something like this is lost?
Yeah, it's gone, but it's there, and we're using it. We're basing whole sciences, agricultural sciences are being based on this. It makes zero sense that we're going to go ahead and study a product that is on every continent, identically made by a culture that is not slashing and burning. So they're not cutting down trees and burning off the foliage to create this biochar. It's the dark earth has no actual origin that we know of in modern, you know, in modern archaeological terms. It doesn't exist. And when are we going to acknowledge that clearly there was a worldwide society that was building something that, and the personality of the soil, it's handling heavy metals and carbon dioxide, and it's the richest growing soil on earth. And it's not, it's self-replicating, as you pointed out in that Cornell study. They're not rotating the crop, and it's constantly repleting the nutrients. So that's nanotechnology. It's we think of it as a biology that it's replacing, I don't know, you know, minerals are not biological in a way. Yeah, you can degrade it, but if you're replenishing those specific minerals, there has to be some, I haven't actually said this before, there has to be an intelligence to the design for it to replace the things that it's depleting. And specifically, it's not overproducing the other minerals, it's just replacing what's lost. And it depends on what you grow in it, determines what's lost. So this is an intelligent soil built by a society millennia ago that is existing in spaces on every part of the continent that's above water that we can test.
Yeah, precisely. And something that, once again, was specifically placed and farmed into existence and still different than the surrounding soil today. And when you start looking at many of the technologies used by ancient cultures, you know, a lot of this show, I think we differ from other shows because we don't necessarily rabbit hole on extraneous hypothesis. We talk a lot to actual researchers. We talk a lot to demystify these topics and to actually get to the root of where the rabbit holes come from. You know, and sure, you can explore the rabbit holes. They're fun, but don't forget they are connected to a root of something. You know, mm-hmm. they're connected to a nexus of other information. And when you start looking at that, and when you start looking at that nexus of other information, that's where you start finding things like terra preta that were common across the globe. That's when you start finding things like being able to make aqueducts, stuff like that. Like those were things that we didn't consider, but Romans had them. Other ancient civilizations had them. You know, even civilizations in Mesoamerica had them.
Yeah. And those are a mystery. The ones in Peru specifically, they're piped in from the Andes and they're piped for miles from 13, 15,000 feet or whatever. And they go for miles and there's no material science data on, oh, it's like, well, they just carved it out of rock and it's looking very well designed and it looks like it has very well machined walls. So was there any epoxies? Was there anything placed on the rock itself? So we don't test it. That was one of the first seasons of, I blew my mind. This is one of the early seasons of Ancient Aliens. They go to Peru and they go to a farmer that's pulling out 10, 15 foot pipes out of the ground. And they're like, these are predating the Incas. And it's like, why are there water pipes everywhere? And everyone's like, well, it's a mystery. It's like, okay.
Yeah. No, precisely. And it's something that, like, even now, there was a huge study done just all of a couple of years ago showing the fact that many of the Nazca lines, not all the Nazca lines, but many of the Nazca lines, specifically the ones that are visible from the ground on hillsides, things like that, the very large petroglyphs, are actively connected to water ceremony. And to mapping where there is localized water in the Atacama Desert. So,
you know, Von Daniken was pointing out that some of them are drained. They actually have drains in them.
Yeah.
They have central drains. So it's like, okay, well, where does the drain go? Anyone? It's like the natural, it's if and when it's, a lot of people don't know this, that the area where the Nazca lines are is drier than Antarctica. It is the driest, absolutely the driest places on Earth. The amount of rain that falls in that area for them to do that, those formations. And yeah, there's shapes and things like that, but a lot of the Nazca lines are geometrically extremely, extremely well done. They don't vary inches to left or right. They go on for kilometers, seem more like earth antennas. So how much of this has to do with, again, the contemporary water sources and what further back in time was the purpose of these engineered lines?
Well, and the purpose of much technology that they had, because once again, we hear technology and we think computer. You know, we always try to put things, humanity is always putting things in their modern parlance. You know, so when you consider technology, when you consider a tool, you know, yes, in the classical sense, a gun is a tool because it helps you hunt food faster.
Yeah.
You know, now should you go around and be hammering everything with that tool? Absolutely not. But even whenever you have a tool, it can become, if that's the only tool in your toolbox, you know, when a hammer is the only tool, eventually everything looks like a nail.
Right.
You know, so it can make a process easier, but it can also at the same time make you pretty myopic as to how you look at things. So
yeah, it's you find what you're looking for.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And that's something that we talk about regularly on the show, the idea of looking at things through certain filters, that kind of stuff. So when you start looking at things through the filter of humanity can do it, and you change that concept once again to the idea of your book, that it doesn't have to be aliens, it could be us, you know, that we have had technologies that we have forgotten about. The example that I bring up regularly is, yes, indeed, let's keep seeing everything instead of taking something to an actual hand carver. You know,
yeah.
Probably about 20 years ago, I could have gone within about a 50-mile radius of anywhere from here with a 6x6 piece of wood just blank and said, I need a spiral wooden column carved, and probably found a few artisans to be able to do it.
Yeah.
You know, the likelihood of that now, you could find someone that could take that and absolutely put it onto a CNC lathe, and they would lathe one out for you with the CNC machine. But the technology of how to carve that in a master's way out of a solid piece of wood without mistake is all but gone. And it didn't even take a generation to do it.
No.
But I also think, though, to that point, I also think that those machines existed hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years ago.
Sure.
So I think that while we've had, you know, artists to do what you're saying, mm-hmm. throughout all pockets of time, we've also had, I think, advanced machine through all pockets of time.
Sure.
Sure. Yeah, I think Christie's, you know, on Christie, that's such a great point. We have a friend of the show that I just watched. It was brought to my attention just the other day that the Bible references don't mix materials and clothing. And it gives the reference for it, but then shows the frequencies of the different polyester, satin, and if you mix the frequencies of the clothes you're wearing, it can be very disruptive to your cellular system.
Sure.
So here's a biblical reference, which is clearly about something more advanced and something we remember left in this, you know, deified, mystified way in the Bible, but it's like it's a true scientific statement that's clearly thousands or tens of thousands of years old or more. It's like don't do this because your frequency energy thing, and you don't.
But that's not how it's interpreted for you know, modern day people.
No,
that are, yeah. The typical people that are interpreting that text are not interpreting it in the form of frequency and energy, and that's where we're getting. I feel like everything is wrong and backwards and a little upside down and inside out.
Well, you know? And that is like literally something that I speak about is the idea of paranormal is science. You know, it's been funny to see science for years poo-poo a lot of these ideas. And, right. You know, there's been a windfall over the last few years since quantum entanglement was proven.
Right.
You know, and now suddenly the ideas of, No, let's do some more lab work into ESP because remote viewing didn't go far enough.
You right.
Know, things like that.
It went pretty far.
It did. But no, it did. And still goes.
One of the things that we talk about just recently on the show was a Hungarian doctor suggested back in the late 1800s, something like that, early 19th.
Weiselwig?
Something like that. He suggested that doctors should wash their hands before tending to little babies. And he was institutionalized and died. He was beaten to death like 14 days.
Yeah, no, like until
completely ostracized from the community.
Demo-wise,
that's right.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, quite.
It's like, oh, of course, it's ludicrous to consider not washing your hands before putting the gloves on.
Yeah.
The disinfected gloves. Let's wash our hands first. Disinfect our hands and then put the disinfected gloves on, then tend to the babies.
Let's send them to an insane asylum.
Shows exactly, I guess, kind of the colonization attitude. You know, but also that very short-sighted concept that we have. We have this idea that all of these things are new ideas. Right. You know, I mean, we didn't start washing our hands. Smooth until the Civil War, they were still talking about ether and the four humors, you know, like, no, your phlegm level is off in your body, you know, so we need to leech you a little bit, which leeches are, hey, they use them in surgery, you know, sure. Like they use all kinds of things that were used and considered witchcraft for a long time in surgery now. You know, it's pretty, one of my favorites is, oh my God, it just left my head. They used it in the Korean War all the time. It was a curare. Curare was a native known substance that was used on like paralytic darts, stuff like that. That we actively adapted for field medical use.
Okay.
To be able to put people out and under in the field. So yeah, like if you watch the show MASH, they talk about using curare all the time.
Do they?
Yeah. Yeah. And since then, like, it's been researched, it's pretty fascinating. But that's a prime example of an actual native used concoction. Same thing as Serpent and the Rainbow. Like, that actively happened. We use the basis of zombie powder to like put people under.
But can't we normalize things not being normal?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
I think that's part of the problem is like, what, can we normalize things not being normal? Or, you know, people, when they come up with these new ideas, like, hey, we should probably wash our hands before messing with tiny new things, you know? Like,
absolutely.
Maybe we just consider that, oh, that's, maybe we should just look at that, you know, instead of just calling people crazy and burning them at the stake.
Oh, no. 1,000%. And I mean, quite literally, that is one of the things that we talk about regularly on this show and on my field observation guide, all kinds of things. Everything from Curious Research has this on it. The actual scientific method. My favorite thing, once again, when I'm talking about paranormal being science,
it's just
observation
basic,
and question. If you had a paranormal observation, if you had a paranormal experience, science has begun. You have observed something, and you had a questionable experience. The only question is, did you buy a ticket to the science train as the experiencer? You know? Yeah. You're already a citizen scientist just by having your paranormal experience. So, like, that's perfectly normalized. It should be. Every scientist should be looking at everything in the point of anomaly until proven. You know, that's science. So it's pretty fascinating how they've been driven apart. When one was utterly there with the other for so long and should be brought back, you know, because, yeah, that is the job of science, is to remove the anomaly from the equation, to prove what the anomaly is and remove it from the data set. And if you can't do that, now you got something truly paranormal. You know, you have that 3 to 5 percentile that we just can't explain. And that's okay, science. You know, like, that's okay, experiencer. And even on the flip side, if we ourselves have had an experience that data later proves to be something else, that does not mean that our experience that changed us didn't happen. You know? So so there is a beautiful kind of meet in the middle idea there, that we both, science and experiencer, have to take into consideration as we move forward with this. Because yes, we are learning more and more that ancient civilizations were right. The calculations that they had, the technologies that they knew about. One of my favorites to bring up all the time is crystals. I hold a crystal all the time during show records. But we are now looking at storing teraflops of data on quartz crystal. This is something that's been talked about, you know, like, even they're calling them Superman crystals, you know, because of the whole, like, data storage of the Kryptonian crystals whenever he, like, slides them in and it, like, projects the hologram of Dad telling him the history of Krypton, things like that. But the idea that we are storing data on nothing but slices of crystal. Here, I'll bring it up right now. Crystal storage. It's pretty wild.
to think that these are things that we have talked about as literally myth for a long time. That was one of the things that was said long ago about the lost civilization of Atlantis, was that they used crystals to store data. But yeah, memory crystals. So just literally on layers of quartz. So nothing more, nothing other than just a slice of quartz to store data on. So yeah, who knows what data storage techniques they had? Who knows how many crystals we've just shattered, done whatever to, that had all kinds of data stored inside of them? And whenever you start talking to somebody who talks about Lemurian crystals or crystals that are record keepers, things like that, that was not something strange to ancient civilizations. It's only strange to us. Even the fact, one of the things I bring up all the time is the chest plate of,
oh yeah,
of the high priests. Like, without this chest plate, they could not approach the Ark of the Covenant. This is one of the things that kept them safe from the Ark of the Covenant, which we know had immense power, like enough to level buildings, whole cities, all kinds of things. You came near it, you were obliterated without the proper spiritual protection. So the idea that, yes, these sacred stones worn in a chest plate of gold by the high priests help ground them and protect them from this. Not strange when you start looking at some of the modern day concepts of crystals and their ability to, like, you know, amethyst for getting rid of electromagnetic frequencies, you know, things like that, the different properties that various crystals and minerals and rocks have according to metaphysics.
Yeah, absolutely. There's not any one combination that I find fascinating, like the chest plate that you brought up they're protecting the Ark of themselves from the Ark. Well, what's the frequency combination? What's being canceled with those specific ones? And there's the other thing. They're using a pattern, or they have them in an order, but they're okay. So there's frequency that's, they're either absorbing or transmuting, and gold. That's interesting that they're using gold as a backplate. So the question then is I wonder if, what if in the tradition of things, this is one of those things where it's like you just said, let's do the scientific method. What are they doing to test whether or not there was only one key or two key of the chest plate crystals? What if those other crystals did other things? But it's not the combination of the whole thing. What if it's just like two or three doing the protection part, but then the other ones could actually, you know, they put them on, but they miss, they're misplacing what they're doing, but we're not experimenting. We don't know.
Well, yeah. You know, it's much like having any partial key, you know, just like kind of like the Voynich manuscript. Things like that. Like, all you really need is we have zero key when it came to other classical languages, other things, even hieroglyphics. The day that we found the Rosetta Stone that had Greek on it,
right,
that matched to the Egyptian, at that point, we had a key. We know Greek.
Yeah.
You know? So that's all it really takes, is finding that key of how was it communicated, you know. And the example I give all the time is, here's a 1 terabyte thumb drive. I got all kinds of things on it. Throw it over my shoulder and let the house fall down 200 years from now if somebody finds it. A, what is it? B, how do you read it? It's a great piece of technology until we literally forget how to use it. Feel free to go show a 20-year-old an 8-track player.
Yeah, oh, my cassette tape half the time.
Well, cassettes have come back, LPs have come back, you know.
That's true,
but it's one of those, like, you go show them another technology that does the exact same thing.
Yeah,
you know, a mini disc, Like, oh my gosh. Their only reference to that might be Neo holding one up at the beginning of The Matrix. Might be the only reference. But it's funny how quick we literally lose these things from our vernacular. And then when you start talking about a global vernacular, this is something that we talk about in the Remote Viewing Association regularly, that they're actively working on with their protocols, which is how do we find an international language? You know, like a lot of science has that international language, like the, hey, that's why they use the metric system, you know, like because everybody uses it. So we all know what a centimeter is. You know, it's a known unit of measure. But if I am a remote viewer in Germany and I'm using a different nomenclature than you are to explain how to write something down, things like that, that may be communicated in a totally different way. As opposed to if we're looking at the data with the same meaning behind the same word. You know, one of the prime examples that has popped up in the last many years is, once again, the island of Atlantis. For years, people have said, we're looking for an island. Unfortunately, in Greek, the word that Plato used for island also means peninsula.
Hmm.
You know, so like once you start, and I forget what the other is, I think it's like an inlet or something like that. So when you start looking at the other two possible definitions of that Greek word that was used, like we've just traditionally said, whoever read it first and said, well, that means island, apparently was not hip to the other two common uses of that word in Greek.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. So like that changes the dialogue. It changes where you're looking. It changes what you're looking for rapidly.
Absolutely. It also makes the Ricott structure really look even more appealing for this answer. But you know what, this came up the other day, yesterday actually, in, you know, we were talking about Atlantis. And again, it could be an allegory, but it's like, sure. He said 13 cities. Okay, so 13's a neat number, but it's not one place. We're not looking for one island. We're looking for the Atlantean society.
That's right.
So where are the, never brought up, where are the other 13? Where are the other 12 places? Where what would constitute this society that was clearly going around with man satchels and man bags and same story, Viracocha, everybody, they're teaching them the plant, they're teaching them numbers, they're teaching an alphabet. It's always kind of a white hipster dude, or usually ginger, redhead guy with a beard, hey, with a man satchel everywhere on Earth. So it's like we got one Peace Corps. We call them Atlanteans, going around helping everybody to stop sacrificing virgins on a full moon or whatever, to like stop banging rocks again. And so where are these other cities? It's not just the one. And the Ricott structure does seem to measure entirely like, the one place. So it'd be an inlet, it'd be a peninsula, and it would be surrounded by ocean. So it's like, okay, well, that's a double perfect word then.
Well, but And once again, when you start looking at things like that through those processing filters, through new eyes of research, because I was just talking with a researcher earlier today, and even in the world of Bigfoot, we're going to go there real quick. One of the things that isn't really brought up is myopia, the purposeful myopia of your mind when you're focusing on something. And the example that you can give is, like, put a pin about 20, 30 feet away from you and just keep focusing on that pin, and you'll slowly start to see almost a tunnel vision form where, like, pictures on the wall next to the pin disappear.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. So the idea of have we even explored the option of the cloaking Bigfoot being that phenomena, the fact that somebody is so hyper-focused in that moment that their mind has literally subtracted the subject of what they're looking at, you know? So looking at the phenomenology of things and being willing to, through new eyes of research, through new concepts like that, you know, it is what changes science and changes the way that we look at things. Because once again, had we had we kept following the philosophy of the four humors, we wouldn't be washing hands when we deliver babies. You know, like we eventually have to be willing to look at things through these new eyes in order to see things. And sometimes those new eyes are literally the original eyes, you know. And a prime example of that is indigens, the literal native medicines that are used. We used to have, and I believe he is dead. Actually, we used to have a researcher on back in the days of Dudes and Beer many, many years ago, Jared.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Yeah. You remember those days.
Oh, I do. We had a good time.
We did. We always had good times. And it was interesting to talk to him because we are now here in Texas looking at funding Ibogaine research. Ibogaine is an African drug. Sourced once again, much like we were talking about earlier from the zombie stuff, things like that, sourced from local indigenous medicine. And Ibogaine can actively be used in what's called a flush dose to help people get over massive opioid addiction. And this has been shown to and sometimes work in one treatment, losing 10 years of opioid addiction.
Wow.
Fascinating, fascinating research being done in it. And it's interesting to see the fact that this is a naturally occurring plant. You know, they have just finally isolated the actual fungus that produces lysergic acid in morning glories and other plants, things like that. So they've wondered for years, and even the person that found lysergic acid in morning glories, wondered and thought that it may be fungal in some way, kind of mycological, like mushrooms, you know, and that was the source. He'd always hypothesized it, but we just found that. Morning glory seeds have been used by Native American tribes for depression and things like that for generations, you know? So the idea of modern medicine finally hipping to indigens and coming around to the point, I forget who it was that used to be head of the World Health Organization, who years ago came out and said, like, no, the information I've been given on marijuana did not actively show studies. Come to find out, once I got out of there and found other researchers, I found tons of studies that actively showed the medical applications of marijuana. I was never shown these when I was part of the World Health Organization. They told me they did not exist. So it's fascinating to see that. And it's interesting to see the growth in society of acceptance with such things, you know, like literally within my lifetime, to the point of recreational use, to the point of therapeutic medical use of marijuana, to the point of therapeutic medical use for depression of mushrooms. And they are actively looking at ayahuasca as one of these indigens for possible medical study. And that is fascinating to see that. And I'm not going to say that it rapidly came on the scene. Like, it's been on the radar for years and years and years. But there has been, over the last easily 10 years, a large surgence of people taking ayahuasca journeys, ayahuasca trips, things like that. We were talking about it before the show, Christy. I've been on ayahuasca journey. It's a beautiful, beautiful experience when done properly. And it's interesting to see even that making its way back to the mainstream.
Yeah, I agree. I think it has huge mental, emotional, physical, spiritual, there's so many benefits behind the plant itself. That I think the concern would be it becoming a little too westernized, you know. I think that it is such a sacred practice, and there's a reason why it's sacred, and I think that it needs to be kept inside those indigenous communities that have been practicing this, you know, for generations. So I think it's kind of a catch-22. You want it to be readily accessible for everyone who needs it, at the same time, you don't want it to become like Western medicine, and it's and then the actual, because there's more benefit than just the medicine itself. Like, it's, you can't, I don't believe that your ayahuasca sitting with the medicine in a, you know, commercialized facility in the States versus sitting with the medicine in the Andes Mountains. It's just completely, you know, with the tribe itself, with the Shipibo people or whoever you choose to sit with, you know, then it's just a different experience, I think. So
I would definitely, yes. That is definitely different than a clinical atmosphere, absolutely. Yeah. And that, but you know, that brings up a point of eventually it's got to hit the clinical, you know.
Right.
And how do you, I guess, marriage that, you know? How do you clinicize something that is meant to be taken in a different atmosphere? You know,
I don't know that it's ever going to happen in the way that we would like to see it happen, just because I don't think that there's ever going to be, you know, once Big Pharma has anything to do with it, once, you know, we start involving politics and corrupting it with, you know, what we know to happen in the States, it's going to become about money and greed and power and control.
Yeah,
which is gonna taint the effects of the medicine itself, and do a disservice really to the practice, the sacred practice of sitting with the medicine. So, I don't know that it's ever gonna. I think that we would be amiss to think it's ever gonna be what we would like it to be, and fully respected in the way that it should be.
Yeah,
if we bring it here to the States.
Well, and you know, especially in, sadly, in the way that most people from the States view things. And the prime example I can give to that is Amsterdam. Mm. They no longer allow canna tourism the way that they once did. Mm-hmm. And it's mainly because of Americans. Not even joking.
No surprise there.
The idea of being able to just like walk in anywhere and get a joint and smoke it. Yeah. Like, no. Americans went out and got like ounces of reefer and like rolled joints in the middle of like city parks and stuff like that. And it's like, no, you know what you're not supposed to bring to the city park where the kids are playing? Your reefer.
Yeah.
Kind of like bringing your bottle of Jack Daniels to the park here in Texas with a crazy straw. You know,
right.
not really where you're supposed to enjoy your crazy straw whiskey, you know? And that's just it. You know, there is that. Even whenever I was in college, I remember friends like would get mushrooms on a Wednesday night and like have a test the next day. And I'd be like, I will keep mine for my sacred moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I'll keep mine for the right place, right time when I'm like creating some art. You know, things like that, because, yes, even though it does that to you, should that be the end result of what you're using it for? You know,
respecting the medicine, respecting the plant.
Well, any of it.
Respecting the wisdom. Yeah.
Any of it. And understanding the fact, much like the ancients did and the societies that used these things for religious purpose, understanding that it is the frequency of vibration that you are emanating to use it. Before you ever even use it,
right?
You know, much. It's kind of the same way that a heroin addict starts getting high during preparation.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even have to use the smack; their brain starts releasing the chemicals, the same chemicals as when they use while they're preparing. Mm. You know, so the fact that your brain is already entering that frequency of thought. It's already releasing the chemical to get to that place. Yeah. So it's pretty fascinating to think about that. And when you start thinking about the frequency of thought when you're using something, the frequency of thought of what you're using something for, no different than like I almost made Curious Realm answer boards for pendulums at one point. pretty cool piece of swag. Could have sold tons of them at the conferences that I go to. However, responsibly, should I do that? Should I invite the average user to go out and start asking questions of voices from the beyond? No. I should not encourage that. I shouldn't encourage people to go out and use Ouija boards. Are there people that I know who use them? Yes. However, they're pretty adept at a lot of other things. You know? But I wouldn't recommend a 13-year-old go off and use a Ouija board. You know, because you may just be putting out a frequency of invitation for something else to hijack its way in. And no different than using a high-powered hallucinogen for a non-sacred purpose. Things right. like that. It is the intent with which you are using it that begins the experience to begin with.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's something that we have vastly, vastly as a society lost connection with. We've talked about it regularly on the show, Jared. Just the idea of, I take astrophotography. I do it because I love it. My grandfather knew the stars in the sky because it told him when to go fish with what.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, like he grew up farming and hunting and trapping, things like that. So he knew during the springtime when these stars rose, these fish would be biting, you know, that kind of stuff. We were connected to the world around us in a totally different way because we had to be. Without that, we didn't live. Society didn't live and move forward if we didn't know what happened when these stars came into the sky. We don't need that now. We have the comfort of roof over our head that doesn't fall over in a breeze, you know. We have the comfort of pretty regular supplies of food across most of the globe in civilized world, you know. So we've vastly lost connection with those things that keep a native culture grounded, not only spiritually, but materialistically.
Right.
So, go ahead.
No, I was just saying you're right. I agree completely.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting to see that. And when you start looking at the ideas of, once again, ancient technology, we tend to throw circuits into technology and things like that. We don't consider something like a bow drill. You can even drill through things with a bow drill, you know. You use a core of a harder mineral, you can start drilling into harder minerals with a bow drill. So yeah, the same technology can be used to do all kinds of stuff. It's pretty fascinating. And the fact that you guys are working with Michael Cremo right now is absolutely awesome. Let's spend the last few minutes talking about this amazing upcoming online event from Michael and the release of his new book, Jared.
Yeah, it's Extreme Human Antiquities, which is Michael's website. And there's a link to the webinar, which we will be hosting Wednesday, which I realize that we're doing this for Tuesday. So that would be tomorrow night. That would be
Wednesday. Absolutely. And
tomorrow, dinner time, and we will be hosting a Q&A afterwards with him, so people will be able to ask questions. And you can pre-order the book at Extreme Human Antiquity. You're going to be able to listen in for him to speak on this new book, and then, you know, we'll be hosting, Christy and I will be hosting that, and then we'll be hosting the Q&A afterwards. And then after that, I don't know how far out we are, it's not too far, but we'll be co-hosting with Michael a new podcast. So we'll still be doing RQX, but we will be co-hosting a brand new podcast with Michael for the first time. This is something he's been wanting to collaborate, and it's just fallen the ways of we're doing it.
Well, I am excited for you guys because, of course, I mean, the RQX episodes have been awesome. You guys have been tackling some great topics. And even right now, there has been so much in the world of archaeology. They have come out with more information on the Dragon Man skull here in the last month and a half. which is absolutely amazing. I still don't know what to make of all of the pyramid scans. There's been a second round of pyramid scan data that's dumped. And yeah, that's one of those kind of like the Booga sphere where I'm like, yeah, I don't really know about that.
I'm just getting caught up on all this stuff because I just got back a few days ago. So
yeah,
I saw something about the Booga sphere on the news while I was at the airport. But outside of that, I have no idea what's happening here. So what's happening with the pyramids?
Well, there was the original scan of the pyramids, right, that was done that, you know, I mean, we kind of talked about it last time we had you guys on, where it's like, I don't know if the marriage of technology that they're talking about can really pull this kind of detail. Well, they have new scans with new detail and things like that. And it's like, it's still one of those, I don't know about
it's
that.
It's questionable?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm still...
So what about the Bugasphere? Is that a thing?
I would be interested to talk to the gentleman that found it. There are a few things when you start getting into, especially some of the close-ups. I'll bring it up real quick.
I'm super curious what your opinion is, Chris.
Well, really, I've had my heart broken by Jaime Musan numerous times, and I'm not really prone to go back to the same lady. When the reveal keeps being horrible, you know,
right?
And it's one of those that, yeah, I don't know about it, mainly because Jaime Musan is directly behind it and heavily behind it, and a lot of what he has done, a lot of what he has said, has come to the point of nil, has come to the point of being hoax time and time again. And this is one of those where it's like, I kind of wish Jaime Musan was not involved because of that. Because yeah, it's strange. Let me see how close I can get this here, without ads blocking it and stuff like that. I have to kind of zoom in on this website, but some of the details from this piece of quote alien made material, are not that great. Like, you can see here on... you can see on the image where, like, this is a very well-defined circle. This one not so deep on that part.
Yeah.
You know, there's some parts that kind of look like they've been hit with a Dremel tool. That kind of stuff. Where it's like... there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of like really unmachined precision. Let's put it that way, where it's like, you know, a force beyond what you could get at your local Lowe's or Home Depot helped make this.
I'll have to do a little digging on that one.
And there's been reports of it changing mass during its investigation, during people investigating it in the lab. There have been reports of fiber optics being found inside, which, I guess if you're molding something out of pure aluminum, you could throw some fiber optics in there. It's glass, you know. You put it in at the right temperature, it may not melt. I don't know. But
Chris, did someone unscrew it? How do they know that? Did they take an x-ray?
Yes. X-rays. Oh. Things like that. Once again, I would love for it to be an alien technology. I think that would be great.
But we'll see.
We'll see what comes out. You know, much like the skeletons that are still out there right now from Paracas. It's like, I guess we'll see. But right now, a lot of it looks very much the same data that has been presented before, which was shown to be falsified. So, once again, I wish Jaime Musan was not involved, because some of the images and things like that are interesting. You know, like, hey, even here, the difference between the top, one of them having gold, the other not. You know, one of them looking filled in, the other not. yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. There's been a lot of different stuff. So it's one of those, it's hard to, without actively having access, I've been wanting to have a couple people on who have had close up access with it, on the show. And I have reached out to them, but not heard back. So we'll see what happens. I would love to do a whole Bugasphere episode, but it's also one of those, I don't like diving down hard rabbit holes. I like talking to actual investigators. So I would much rather talk with someone who has spent time with the sphere and hear what their learned opinion is on it after having seen it and investigated it by hand. But just from what I can tell, as far as like, I belong to a lot of maker groups, you know, like I modify circuits and things like that. So like I have friends that make Star Wars props, things like that from scratch, all kinds of things. People that mill their own lightsaber handles, that kind of stuff.
We all have to keep us posted on what you find.
Yeah, yeah. And it's one of those, belonging to those groups and having that experience and seeing what I see on all the pictures, I think there could be a lot more detail attained if they were using some different techniques. But yeah, I don't know. For me, it doesn't look alien made as far as I'm concerned. The precision is not there. So we'll see, though. We'll see what comes of it. And much like any research, that's just it. Like, we have to be willing to look at that beautiful wheel once again of the scientific method and be willing to accept that and like right now I'm working on an active experiencers group. And that's part of it, is that we have to be willing to accept that we have had an experience to begin with. Like you were saying, Christy, to be able to normalize. We just had a guest on last week who's literally talking about the psychological concept of normalizing the paranormal, that it's okay that you had a paranormal experience. People may not believe you, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't believe yourself. You know, and yes, when it comes to science, when it comes to these things, we have to remember that somebody's experience is where the science begins. It's only the beginning of a scientific investigation, that point of experience. So it's important for us to remember that always, even as researchers, that somebody else can come in and provide us a whole new data set that changes everything if we have an open mind to do so. So thank you guys, as always, for joining, for coming on. Let everybody know where they can go to find out more about the Extreme Human Antiquity event going on tomorrow, Wednesday.
It will be hosted on rkeox.com. We'll have it on the main page, and you can buy tickets at Extreme Human Antiquities. And rkeox.com, that'll be for Wednesday night. Well, Wednesday at basically Central Time, 5. Mm-hmm. And
7 Central.
Yeah. So Christy's on top of it. So that'll be it. And we look forward to seeing everyone who wants to join. And it will be available after the broadcast. It will be of course, subscribers, and it'll be viewable, but it will not be open to the public. It will definitely be a pay-per-view moving forward. And then, of course, the future podcast will have more information about what we're going to do with Michael co-hosting with Christy and I doing a brand new podcast. And we're hoping to have some exciting guests.
Great. I cannot wait to hear more and more and more about that, guys. Thank you so much, as always, for coming on. Greatly appreciate it. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online, checking out everything from our friends over at ArcheoX, as well as getting your tickets to the upcoming Michael Cremo book release, the special online event over at extremehumanantiquity.com. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can visit our store to get all of the books, videos, classes, everything from our guests, including the all-new Curious Research Remote Viewing Session Journal. If you are a remote viewer out there, stop on by and buy your copy of the Remote Viewing Session Journal. That is your chance to be able to keep all of your remote viewing sessions in one place for ease of comparison between data, things like that, to start better chronicling your sessions. So thank you so much, everybody, for your time tonight. Thank you so much for your time every week. It is your open hearts, your open minds that make the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit GroundZeroPlus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.